So this is just a really quick slide, just the folks that helped and that I with on the working group. I just want to briefly thank them. We have staff from GARFOS, SFD, Sustainable Fisheries Division, Protected Resources Division, and we also had folks from the Northeast Fisheries Science Center. And as you can see, we had folks from a variety of state fisheries agencies down the coast. Next slide, please. So this is a brief overview of the action plan. So what it does is it communicates the results of the working group's review of the available information regarding Atlantic sturgeon bycatch. It describes regulatory measures that the working group recommends that the New England and Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Councils consider in order to reduce bycatch by 2024, and it establishes a time frame for the development of those measures and further evaluation of post-release mortality. So just briefly, in the action plan, we have a description of our fisheries that we're talking about here. We have an overview of our review of the available information, some conclusions that the working group drew from that review, and then specifically the recommendations and the timelines. Next slide, please. So this is just a list of essentially the fisheries that were included in the biological opinion that technically were evaluated in the action plan. Obviously, some of these FMPs or ISFMPs are for fisheries that don't prosecute their fisheries with gill net. So, like, for example, the lobster fishery is not gill net fishery. So these are technically included, but not really focused on in the action plan itself. And the action plan walks through each of these FMPs. And so really, the ones that we're going to be focusing on today and in the action plan are monkfish, northeast multi-species, skate, spiny dogfish, and bluefish. Those are the fisheries that we see gill net effort in. Next slide, please. So this is just a brief overview of the information review that was conducted. The information that we reviewed included peer-reviewed scientific papers, available data from the Northeast Fisheries Observer Program database, grant program reports, workshop reports, the Northeast Fisheries Science Center model direct estimates of Atlantic sturgeon bycatch, and the 2017 ASMFC stock assessment for sturgeon. So topics explored by some of these sources included distribution and occurrence of Atlantic sturgeon, analysis of bycatch information, and work on bycatch mitigation, particularly gear modification. And so these sources represent the known information available to the working group. And in the action plan itself, there is a literature cited section, so obviously people can go and see what we looked at. Next slide, please. And so from the review of all that information, we made a couple of conclusions, running through them quickly. First is that federal gill net fisheries targeting monkfish, spiny dogfish, and northeast multi-species with sink gill net gear ranging from 5.5 to 10 inches and minimum mesh size requirements are primary contributors to Atlantic sturgeon bycatch. I'll note that the way this is worded, we used minimum mesh size requirements to kind of define the fisheries that we're talking about. I think I heard some, like I said, we've given this presentation at the mid, and I've also talked about this at Crownfish Committee, Monkfish Committee, and so I heard that this was kind of a confusing way to set this up, so I think in the finalized version, we'll say something more like federal gill net fisheries targeting monkfish, spiny dogfish, and northeast multi-species with this gear using the range of mesh sites that they actually use, not just the requirement. Just a quick clarification on that. The next is that low-profile gill net designs with reduced net height, shorter tie-down length, and shorter tie-down spacing reduce Atlantic sturgeon bycatch potentially without reduction in catch target species. Next one, soak time is a likely driver of Atlantic sturgeon bycatch rates and mortality based on available research and just kind of the straightforward concept that when the longer your gear is in the water, the greater the chance that the gear interacts with sturgeon, and the longer the gear is in the water, if you have interacted with sturgeon, the greater the chance that that interaction is going to result in mortality. Next slide, please. Continuing on with this, available research indicates that temperature and depth are primary drivers of Atlantic sturgeon movement and abundance. In particular, sturgeon tend to occur in water shallower than 50 meters in depth and shallower than 25 meters in depth during seasonal coastal movements from marine waters to river estuaries in the spring and from river estuaries to marine waters in the fall. And I think a big part here is that migratory pathways along the coast that are used by many sturgeon represent key areas of high abundance. So those migratory pathways that fish are using are important areas that we need to pay attention to. And then finally, post-release mortality for Atlantic sturgeon is not very well understood. We have a small amount of information on the topic, and the research that we do have is hampered by some small sample size. And I can talk about that a little later. Next slide, please. And so from those conclusions, the sturgeon bycatch working group developed some recommendations that fisheries managers consider three primary approaches to achieve bycatch reductions by 2024. These are modifications to gear, modifications to fishing practices, and considerations of areas of focus in regions where Atlantic sturgeon bycatch is the most common. I want to point out that these approaches and any more specific measures recommended within them are not mutually exclusive. Some combination of approaches could be implemented to balance desired bycatch reduction with the needs of affected fisheries. I'll also point out that this is, all of these measures are intended to kind of form the foundation of, what eventually is put into place to reduce sturgeon bycatch. So I'll just continue on, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go forward. But again, the idea here is that you could mix and match measures as you want to implement to balance bycatch reduction with what the fishery needs to operate. Next slide, please. So modifications to gear. The working group recommended that the councils consider requiring the use of low-profile gonaut gear by federally permitted vessels on a monkfish day at sea while participating in a large mesh exemption area with a minimum mesh size of 10 inches, or fishing under a northeast multi species day at sea in a large mesh day at sea program. The working group considers a low-profile gillnet design to have a mesh size ranging from 12 to 13 inches, a net height ranging from 6 to 8 meshes tall, a tie-down length of 24 inches, tie-down spacing of 12 feet, and a primary hanging ratio of 0.50. Next slide, please. The working group further considered the net which showed the greatest success in bycatch mitigation without reduction of target species catch. Was one used by Fox et al. 2019. This net had a 13-inch mesh size, had a net height of 8 meshes, 12-inch tie-down spacing, 24-inch tie-down length, 12-foot tie-down spacing, and that net happened to be 12 panels, 1,200 feet long. This low-profile net showed no significant reduction in monkfish catch by a vessel based out of New Jersey. It did, however, show some significant reduction in monkfish catch by a New York vessel. So I think it's important to note here that, that continued experimentation find that net configuration that works the best is important. But it needs to be balanced with the need to implement meaningful bycatch reductions as soon as possible to result in bycatch to meet conservation goals for Atlantic sturgeon. Next slide, please. Modifications to fishing practices. So based on that conclusion that soak time is, a factor, the sturgeon working group recommends that the councils consider measures to reduce soak time of gill nets deployed by federally permitted fishing vessels on those trip types that you saw before. Important to note here that soak time can vary greatly across the relevant fisheries, just based on regional differences in fishing practices and conditions. What people like to do in terms of soak time can vary wildly. So more work might be needed to understand those differences. It's also worth noting that measures to reduce soak times may be particularly challenging to enforce. The agency has explored the development of data loggers which could be used for this purpose. But it is also worth noting that regulatory changes which do not require the use of loggers may also be possible. And these are things that either, prevent gear from being left in the water for periods of time, or modifications to the regulations for specific fisheries like monkfish that improve overall efficiency, and so that gear doesn't have to be left in the water for longer periods of time. Next slide, please. And so last bit is areas of focus. So the working group looked at observer data from the NEPOP database to identify areas where a high incidence of Atlantic sturgeon bycatch in our gillnet fisheries occurred, and identified several regions along coasts, which roughly correspond to available examples from our literature review. Next slide, please. So the working group recommended that the council consider small, focused, and potentially seasonal measures within the areas of focus identified as containing a high incidence of Atlantic sturgeon bycatch. We note that it's when you use observer-based data, it's strongly related to fishing effort. The working group initially considered but ultimately discarded broad area-based measures based on the presumption of high negative impact of the fisheries involved. So essentially what we're saying here is that we draw boxes in the next couple maps below, but we're not trying to suggest that the boxes that are being drawn are these large closure areas or large regulated gear areas that need to occur. They're just meant to draw focus to these areas and say, okay, if you're going to do small focus, potentially seasonal measures, these are where you would need to do them. And I think further work would be needed to evaluate trade-offs and potential impacts. And the last thing I'll say before I get into the actual areas is that this is where the combination of approaches kind of becomes a thing to consider. So if you were looking at small focused seasonal measures, you could design that seasonal measure as a gear restricted measure where low profile gillnets are required, or you don't have to, where you could, decide that you just want to close fishing into that area for a period of time where you think where it's thought that Atlantic sturgeon bycatch is highest. So that's where the combination of approaches where mix and matches is kind of something to consider. Next slide, please. So just looking at the Gulf of Maine, I'll just note that these are largely adjacent to the Western Gulf of Maine closed area. So these are observed sturgeon interactions split up seasonally. And so we have the blue and purple dots are what we would call winter months. January, March is our blue, and then the purple is October through December. And we have green being the spring, and then red being a summer. Again, when you're looking at observer information, a lot of this is going to be heavily influenced by where people are fishing. And I'll note that this is adjacent to the Western Gulf of Maine closed area for the groundfish fishery. So it's very closely correlated to fishing activity. And again, I'm just reminding folks that the box itself is not proposed as a closed area or otherwise, just an area to attract focus. And we see here that there's not really a whole lot of there's activity in the winter, but there's not a whole lot of patterning here to help make decisions. Next slide, please. Next area is the Southern New England Cox's Ledge. Again, things are pretty diffuse, not a whole lot of discernible pattern. We do see it's very clear here that we do see activity in the spring months, say April through June, and then not much in the summer, and then activity from October through December, which is consistent with the literature that suggests that bycatch is higher in these spring fall months, correlating with sturgeon movement. And bycatch tends to be lower in the summer, even though that's a time of the year where a lot of people are still fishing. Next slide, please. So this is the New Jersey area. This is where things are a little bit more easy to discern in terms of seasonal patterns. So we do notice that bycatch occurs closer to the shore in the spring months, so these green months, these green dots, while bycatch tends to be more diffuse and offshore in the fall and winter months. I'll note that Dutton et al. Proposed a small area off of Sandy Hook to protect habitat and juvenile sturgeon. That's not really reflected here in this information, but it's possible that this is just the observer database, so obviously, this does not reflect all the bycatch around that specific Sandy Hook area. I'll also note that migratory patterns explored by Erickson et al. Imply that migratory pathways are in this area. So, we have sturgeon coming from the Hudson that migrate throughout the middle and bite. So, if they're going from the Hudson down south, they're going to need to migrate through this area. And I think you see that in the, in those spring months when you have the migratory pathways less than 25 meters close to shore down through, to the Mid-Atlantic Bight. Last thing I'll note in this, with this area is that there is bycatch of Atlantic sturgeon, just south of Long Island. I didn't clarify, I should have. This is all gillnet gear. The bycatch of Atlantic sturgeon that we do see just south of Long Island is all trawl gear, and so this is not, that's not reflected in this fishery. And I think that's, again, what I, maybe what I was trying to say when I was talking about the small area off Sandy Hook to protect habitat and juvenile sturgeon. This is just gillnet gear, so it doesn't reflect that trawl gear that is happening in this area as well. Next slide, please. Moving up the coast, there are three general areas of interaction with sturgeon along Delmarva and south of Chesapeake, and so these are the northernmost two. So this in farther up, farther north area here, again, there's a little bit of patterning here with the green dots close to the shore and some of the winter interactions a little bit more diffuse and offshore. Again, this might be more related to where people are fishing at a given time. Again, we do think that this reflects the migratory pathways kind of idea that the fish are moving close to shore down, up and down the coast. And again, evidence from both Breese et al. 2016 and Erickson et al. 2011 support measures from the mouth of Delaware Bay to the mouth of Chesapeake Bay, which correlates with what we've seen here in the observer data. This area southeast of Chincoteague is not as clear seasonally, although I will note that the majority of the points do seem to occur in what we've labeled as winter, so both October through December and January through March. Next slide, please. This is the final area for their... this one is a little bit, again, less clear seasonal patterning, but again, we'll note that the most interaction occurred in those October through December and January through March months. Next slide, please. So moving on, the last piece of the action plan that was required was a bit on post-release mortality. Understanding of post-release mortality is poor, and the only available information is a tagging study that doesn't have a whole lot of, did not have a whole lot of samples. So as a result, the working group recommends that the councils, the ASMFC, and NOAA Fisheries prioritize focused research in two subordinate categories. So these are quantitative estimates of post-release mortality rates, so understanding, you know, the numbers involved in terms of post-release mortality, and then development of injury assessment guidelines for entangled sturgeon. So to inform development of these recommendations, the working group studied the workshop-style approach used to develop technical guidelines for assessing injury of sturgeon of sea turtles, which began in 2003. And so what this was is the agency conducted an initial assessment of the magnitude of injuries from sea turtle interactions with sea scallop dredge gear. They did that through a issuance of a questionnaire sent to various experts in the sea turtle veterinary medicine and rehabilitation fields. They used that to generate working guidelines for scallop gear, and then eventually to extend those guidelines to other fishing gear, the workshop was held and technical guidelines were produced. I'll note that that process is not one-to-one applicable to sturgeon necessarily, the working group determined, mostly because the network of experts in sea turtle veterinary medicine and rehabilitation is much more developed. I don't know that the network of experts that we have for sturgeon is not as well developed, and so we would have to take some extra steps to develop that. Next slide, please. And so as a result, the working group recommended a two-phased approach with three objectives. And those three objectives are to develop protocols and criteria for the rapid visual assessment of live Atlantic sturgeon captured in gillnet gear to allow estimation of post-release mortality. Second objective is to facilitate information gathering of new data that quantifies post-release mortality of sturgeon caught in gillnet gear. And the final objective, is to explore options for a citizen science program for gillnet fishermen to facilitate long-term assessments of post-release mortality. So basically, the first step of this approach to meet those objectives should be led by NOAA Fisheries to identify steps needed to acquire additional information to inform post-release mortality. So the first phase is basically the agency needing to identify, you know, what steps we need to take to meet those three objectives above. The second phase is for NOAA Fisheries to collaborate with partners at the councils and AFC to carry out any of the steps that were identified by the agency to produce technical guidelines for observers. So identify the steps we need to take, work with you all and the AFSMFC to carry out those steps and eventually produce guidelines for observers to assess sturgeon injury and help estimate mortality. Next slide, please. And so these are the timelines. I apologize. I hate putting timelines on slides because they always are just jam-packed with information. I won't read everything here, but I'll note that we are in the third line there, presentation of the New England Council. I've already given a presentation at the MIB, and I will give another presentation at the ASMFC. And so from there, we'll finalize an action plan in September, which will lead into the priority setting process and the implementation plan process for the New England, the Mid-Councils in the fall. If the councils decide to develop an action under MSA, this is a general timeline for their development, and so we imagine that development will occur from January through April of 2023, and then final action in September of 2023, and then council submission in December of 2023, so that we can publish a final rule and implement measures by the start of the monkfish and multi-species fishing years on May 2024. If the councils decide not to include sturgeon bycatch mitigation measures in its 2023 priorities, the biological opinion still requires us to reduce bycatch by 2024, and so NIMS would need to develop an action under the Endangered Species Act to do so. And so the timeline is there on the right, and again, we would shoot for final rule and implementation by the start of the groundfish and muckfish fishing years. Next slide, please. And this is, again, I'm not going to read all this. This is the actions to address post-release mortality from Gill and Gill, the timeline for that. And so basically we would spend the rest of 2022 and 2023 identifying all the steps that we need to take to achieve our objectives, as well as who we think would be the organization to lead for each of those steps. And then in the year, and then 2024 and 2025 would be spent carrying out all of those steps to produce technical guidelines for our observers. And then by 2026, anything else that needs to be completed, necessary to complete our objectives, should be completed by 2026. Next slide, please. And that's it for the presentation, but I am open to questions. And I will note that I regret that I forgot to put my contact information here. As I mentioned, the action plan is a draft. We're producing a finalized version in September. So if folks want to comment or in a forum that's not today, if they want to submit something written, if you go on our website and search Atlantic Surgeon Action Plan, there should be a bulletin page for that with my contact information. And I can also try to get contact information supplied to the council. They have my contact information. To provide to people to submit anything written. But I'll yield from there.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Talmadge. So we'll see if we have any questions or comments from the council. Mr. Alexander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation, Mr. Talmadge. Appreciate all the information. On slide 11, I was curious, when you list the specifications for the large mesh nets, aside from mesh size, can you give a sense on how those other specifications depart from what is current practice?
Yeah, so the I would need to pull up. Give me one moment to flip through my notes to find the general net height. But I do know that the tie down length there is about half of what the fishery normally uses, as I understand, and the tie down spacing is also reduced, and so essentially the bags become, as the net, the tie downs, as they are the net, they kind of produce bags, and so the bags become smaller and more frequent. I'm having trouble finding my... Give me 1 second, sorry. I know I have it written down here somewhere. Well, I'm having trouble finding it. I can follow up after, but that's my general understanding. Is the net height, I think, is normally, 12 meshes high. Folks that have that are actually going to probably correct me on that. But here we go. Yes, mesh depth is typically 12 meshes high, and then tie down length being 48, and then tie down frequency being 24 foot. Is what I have written down here.
Good.
See the knock is on?
Oh my god. She came up to me, dude. She's like, I need a lot of work.
So do I.
Hey, somebody's
got
it. Mark, your mic is live. Okay, Mr. Alexander, are you all set?
No, I was wondering particularly about the length of the nets. If you could comment on that, please.
The 1,200 foot long, I think that varies based on where you're fishing and what program you're fishing in. I do know that this was, I'm not sure entirely what these, what the fishermen that would have been that participated in this particular study would normally be using, to be quite honest. Again, I can follow up with that. And I don't think that, again, I don't think that the intention here is to specify an exact set of specifications that we think the councils have to use. The working group here is just pointing out this is what the most successful net looked like. And again, I've heard a couple at the mid, especially, you know, some fishermen commented on what they think the viability of this setup is. And I think that there are going to be a lot of opinions about the exact specifications and what they need to be in order to for them to fish effectively while still not catching sturgeon. So this is what's being highlighted as what the working group noted is successful, but it's not being put forth as like the gear configuration that has to occur, if that makes sense.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, next I have Mr. Salerno, then Mr. Tracy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Talmadge, again for this presentation. I did saw this through the Ground Fish Committee a couple weeks ago. I've had a few more thoughts about this. In looking at these gear modifications, I guess I'll just state the obvious. You know, with these recommendations of, you know, a 12 to 13 inch mesh with tie downs and these type of measures will pretty much effectively shut down almost every gillnet fishery except for monkfish, and I still think it will have specific ramifications to the catch of monkfish. So obviously the approach of straight gear modifications for any and all fisheries is probably not appropriate. It may be a combination of the seasonal type of area-based information as well. I did want to point out, looking at these maps that you put in here, and your reference, well, it seems like the bycatch is related to the seasonal migration patterns of sturgeon. I would also point out that it's also a result of the seasonal bycatch of the seasonal pattern migration patterns of the target species as well. You know, I'm looking at these bycatch, and you have some in the spring, some in the fall, some in the winter, some in the summer. In my opinion, in my belief, that that's actually related to different fisheries. And I understand that this was kind of a first approach of presenting this information. But I would think if we were at the committee level, I would be more interested to see the bycatch by target species, which I believe would be able to tease out in the observer data. So I'll just kind of throw that out there as a recommendation if a committee does want to take this on, that they actually see the data that's related to the specific fishery FMP that they are working on. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Tracy, then Ms. Ware.
Thank you. So it sounds like there's quite a bit of work to do on the question of post-release mortality, but, and maybe it was in the presentation, maybe I just didn't get it. What about on the observed interactions, the mortality rate when obviously the net is hauled? Did you say that, or do you have information on that? What that data point would be?
So I don't have the data point in this or the action plan. There might be some. We do in the observer data. We have basically three or four categories of status of the animal. We have alive, we have dead, we have dead damaged, and we have dead head only, which is kind of humorous to me. There's only like one or two of those. But so obviously from all of the data points, if you pulled out all the Sturge interactions, you could, you know, take all of the dead, dead damaged, dead head only, and see what proportion of the interactions are animals that are dead and kind of roughly scope out, you know, how many, like, what the mortality is there. And I think that the thing that the post-release mortality piece is trying to clarify, you know, is that not every animal that swims away alive at the time of release is going to continue to survive, you know, in the short near term, because of maybe potentially injuries that were received during that interaction. And so the post-release mortality piece is giving us the tools to be able to evaluate sturgeon that are caught alive, their injuries, and whether they have a chance of survival, and then and estimating based on that how many do eventually die. And from that information, plus the dead, obviously we know those fish are dead, plus the dead fish, we can better understand mortality rates as a whole.
Okay, if I'm just continuing then. Thank you for the answer. But I guess the simple question is how many are dead in any condition, and then how many are alive? And obviously, it sounds like the work to be done is to assess survivability after they're released alive. But do you have that? Is there a percentage, I guess, to ask it as simply as I can, of when the net's hauled back? How many are dead and how many are alive?
I do have that information. It's off the top of my head. I don't. Give me like one moment and I can probably pull something up. It isn't. There is a description of general trends in the NEPHOP data in the action plan itself, talking about you know, where we see. That information is available, and I don't have it off the top of my head. I guess the simple answer.
Okay. I'm curious about that, but I appreciate your answer. Thank you, Spencer.
Ms. Ware, then Mr. Smith.
Thank you. Hi, Spencer. Two questions. My first is a process question. So if the councils decide to take up this action through the MSA process, for species like monkfish and spiny dogfish, where there's two or three management bodies participating in the management of that species, do all of those management bodies need to prioritize this for 2023 to take that route, or how does this work with multiple management bodies on a single species?
That's a good question. I think that, you know, with your jointly managed, I would think that with the jointly managed FMPs, I would assume that, you know, some amount of agreement would need to occur. I'm getting G-chat, so maybe somebody can save me here. Mike would like to address this.
Yeah, you're going to phone a friend. Go ahead, Mr. Pentney.
Thanks. Yeah, so for the case of spiny dogfish and monkfish, which are both jointly managed by the Mid-Atlantic and New England councils, it would require a joint action of both councils to change the regulations and consider these mitigation measures. So yes, to the question, both councils in those two cases would have to prioritize the action and initiate the action. Yeah, I'll stop there.
Mr. Nice.
So I differ a little bit there. I agree that both councils have to vote on the action finally, but we generally have not really asked the other council to cooperate on setting priorities. We generally let the lead council set the priorities for the plans. It's sort of trivial, but I think it's specific to Megan's question. You know, presumably we would adopt it as a priority for monkfish, they would adopt it as a priority for dogfish, and we'd each ultimately have to vote on it.
And I think this is why I'm asking that question, is if, let's say, the New England Council prioritizes this and the Mid-Atlantic doesn't, what does that mean? Does that mean it defaults to NOAA, or does that mean now the New England Council is taking the full lead on that?
My opinion is I'm not sure, okay? I think what would happen, I mean, this happens all the time, to be honest. There have been times when there have been issues that we thought the Mid-Atlantic Council should take up under spiny dogfish with regards to trip limits, and they didn't schedule it. Okay, so it didn't happen, but they didn't want it to happen, right? So our input really didn't do anything there. But they're the lead council, so they were in the lead. Similarly, when we did monkfish, the history's a little vague there, this is a long time ago, but we were talking about trying to set up a sector program in monkfish. And the Mid really wasn't on board with that idea. Ultimately, it failed because they weren't on board, and you need to have both councils vote. But we did spend a lot of time working on a sector program for monkfish or ITQ or something like that for monkfish. So what I think would happen here is if we prioritized it and they did not, or they prioritized dogfish and we did not, they would charge ahead, or we would charge ahead with the action. And then the question is, what happens when you get to the final vote? And if the final vote, nothing goes forward, then I think very likely the agency would have to do something.
Okay, that's helpful. My second question was, this is asking the council to participate in some research on the post-mortality information, and I was just curious how the work group envisions the council participating in that research and if there are any resources to help with that additional effort.
I think that there, as people have said, there's a lot of work to be done. I do think that things like council research priority setting is an important step in an RSA priority setting is an important step in getting focused research on people's radars in terms of, you know, helping to identify areas where research needs to occur. So I imagine that would be part of the process. I think that, you know, that's still something that I think would be developed as the agency identifies the steps that we need to take to meet each of our objectives. I think that you know, as we figure out what we need to be doing, that'll provide us a clear picture of how the councils and the commission can assist in that step. I'm sorry, that's not super clear, but maybe the caffeine is not quite kicked in yet.
I think the draft action plan might benefit from some clarity on how you envision the councils participating in research. We had the agency announce earlier this week that monkfish RSA solicitations aren't happening for 2023-2024. There's not an RSA program for multi-species here, so I think I'm struggling to figure out how the councils participate in research, so that would be something good to include in the action plan. Thank you.
Mr. Neese.
Yeah, if the council plans to comment on the action plan, I do think that's an important point. Without going into detail, there's always some questions about how far the councils can go on funding research. And there have been some councils in the past who've been told that is not their role and they cannot spend money funding money for research. So that's an issue at times. And then, since it came up, I have a similar question about information gathering. We're not typically in the business of collecting data. It's not one of the tasks assigned to the councils. So I was a little concerned about that bullet in there also, about councils and the commission and the agency. You know, we're all lumped together as if we all have the same authorities, and I'm not sure we all do.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Ware. Mr. Smith and Mr. Olszewski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Mr. Talmadge, for the presentation. I had two questions. The first, I wanted to follow up on Dan Salerno's regarding gear requirements that may be considered, and I agree with his point that he raised about we should be considering those gear restrictions based on the target fishery that the regulations might be proposed in. My question on this slide was, so the first bullet here says that this gear showed success without reduction of target species catch. And then the second bullet points to significant reduction in monkfish catch by the New York vessel. And so those seem inconsistent to me. So generally speaking, I would hope that as you present this information going forward, you maybe clean up that what I see as an inherent inconsistency between bullet one and bullet two. And I am curious if there's any additional information on why the gear performed well with one fisherman and not so well with the other one. Was there any other factors that were considered or looked at in that research that might explain why it was successful in one and not in another?
Sure, and that's a fair point about those bullets, so I'll try to clean that up. So going from memory here after reading the report, so this is a grant report from some of our bycatch mitigation work. So my understanding is that obviously the two vessels, my understanding of the differences that might have caused this difference in success here, A, that the fishermen were in different locations, and so maybe the bottom topography was a little different. I do think that the net size in terms of the length for the New York vessel was also a little different. It was shorter in length. And I think the other aspect of this is that the overall biomass, or the overall catch rates of monkfish for the New York vessel, there were more monkfish around. And so as the net fills up with fish, because it's a lower profile net, it's shorter. And like I said, the bags are smaller in size. As that net fills up, it starts to kind of fall in on itself. And so my understanding based on reading that report is that the greater, it's kind of paradoxical, but the greater your catch rates in terms of the number of fish that are entering your net, the greater the significant reduction from your control, like the normal net is. So normal net in that scenario would have held up better and caught more fish, whereas the low profile net in that scenario performed a little worse.
Okay, that's helpful, and I think any additional information you can provide to us would be good on that, because consideration of gear modifications are important both for reduction of bycatch of sturgeon as well as the ability to prosecute these fisheries. My other question, I was hoping you might be able to go forward two slides to, I think it was number 13. Maybe not. That's going to be hard to ask the question without the slide, but the slide, because what I was going to ask about that slide is it was a chart and there was a spatial information on the top and on the bottom, and the spatial information in the two was different, and I wasn't understanding what was being displayed in those two charts. But without having them up, there it is.
Yep.
So could you just, it was just unclear to me what the difference between those two are, what the information being presented and what the difference between the top and bottom was.
Yep, that's fair, because I didn't talk about it, and that's my fault. So the top point are the what we're calling in these charts presence, and so these are observed interactions with between gillnet vessels and Atlantic sturgeon. The bottom is just all observer hauls from the time period that was used to construct this data. So these are every single gillnet observer haul in the NEFOP database. And so the point of this slide was to kind of show that, or the point of the map here is to show that, yes, Atlantic sturgeon interactions are going to be pretty heavily correlated with where gillnet fishing effort is occurring, but not all gillnet fishing effort carries the same risk of interacting with Atlantic sturgeon. And so, for example, that there's a large mass of hauls in the all points on the bottom there that like occur, for example, south of Long Island in Connecticut that occur, but we don't see the same amount of disturbing interaction in that area, as we do, say, closer to New Jersey. So that was the point of that map, was to kind of address the question of, like, well, aren't you just mapping fishing effort? And the answer is kind of, but not really.
Okay, thank you. Very helpful. Thanks.
Mr. Olszewski, then Dr. Sisselhein.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Spencer, for the presentation. I apologize if I missed this. I was looking at the time series of the regional bycatch data, that the slides that are below this. Did I miss it somewhere?
So we didn't include the time series in this or the action plan for this data, just to preserve. Just to preserve confidentiality in a way, because you can't identify the time period in which these hauls have occurred. So that's why that study time period is not listed here or in the action plan. I will say that we did look at relatively recent information. It's not like we were dragging information out from like the 1980s to make conclusions. We were looking at information relevant to today's time period.
Understood. I just have a second question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I guess it's more of a comment than a question. It just seems like some of these modifications, the possible gear modifications, minus vertical lines, seem to be in line with discussions of the take reduction teams phase two. And I was just curious as to how these two actions might work together over the coming time frame, because it seems to align closely. I guess I'm just thinking how the two plans might work for a somewhat common goal. So I guess I wouldn't. Yeah. Thank you.
So that's a common question, for good reason. So we do have members of the Sturgeon working group that are participating in the take reduction team process. So the groups are talking to each other. I will note that, you know, this process, in terms of the working group itself, the Sturgeon working group process that I've laid out here essentially culminates in the September finalization of the action plan. So any further work that needs to go in, that needs to occur for Sturgeon, we'll do so through the council processes or through the agency if we have to do something through the ESA. There's time here for both processes to play out and for communication to occur. I will also note that I'm also getting brought into the take reduction team process to comment on fisheries measures, and so there's communication occurring between the TRT and this group itself. But I do think it is, it's reasonable to be concerned that overlapping measures, are something we need to keep in mind. And I do think that in places where the two groups coincide in terms of measures that they might recommend, it's important to make sure that we give, if low profile nets implemented for sturgeon, for example, just an example, assist in reductions in other protected resources interactions, it will be important to account for that in the other processes, and vice versa. So if the take reduction team decides that low profile nets are something that would assist in bycatch mitigation or entanglement mitigation, and some degree of that is implemented, obviously we would need to give folks credit for using that gear in terms of surge and bycatch mitigation. And in terms of the process, I think that's something that we'll have to play out as we get further down the road and figure out, are the councils going to take this up, or is the agency going to take this up, and vice versa.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, I have Dr. Sisselhein, Mr. Aristad, Mr. Papalardo, Mr. Barrett-Levence, and Mr. Pierdenock in that order. So, Dr. Sisselhein.
Thank you, Chair. First, I'd want to say thanks for the presentation. I think it was very good. And I've also spent a little bit of time looking at the report, and my initial impression is that it's well done. So thank you for that. I have no initial impression resulting in a criticism of the report. And I don't want any comments I might make to be interpreted as such. But I do want to comment on process. First, in terms of process, I won't be around, but I would very much encourage that the council does take this up and doesn't leave it to the agency. I think that's just the way it should be done, given the responsibility of the council, and I think it's in the best interest of the public, given the very open, transparent processes that the council has. So I hope that's the way it goes. But I would comment that the council typically acts on scientific information that's been subject to a fairly transparent and well-understood peer review process. And I don't see that there's evidence of that here. I don't really know what has been done in terms of peer review. I note that one of the critical documents, this Fox et al. 2019, I don't know any of the people, well, I don't know Fox certainly, could be an absolutely outstanding report, but it's a technical report from a grant. It's not a peer-reviewed document, so I'd be interested in to what degree the working group itself conducted a rigorous peer review of it. Beyond that, I'm not aware that this document, and again, I'm not criticizing it at all, has been subjected to some independent peer review. I presume that it's perfectly appropriate that the council could initiate such a review through its own SSC process if it wanted to. So I just throw that out as a thought. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Well, go ahead, Spencer. Sorry.
I was just going to address the one question that was asked there, is if the working group itself conducted any sort of rigorous peer review of that document, and the answer is no. It did not conduct a specific peer review for that document.
You all set, Mike? We'll address the priorities thing at the end. So, Mr. Aristed, then Mr. Pappalardo.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Great presentation. I just have a really basic question. It's somewhat of a follow-up to the line of questioning that Mr. Tracy was asking about mortalities in the various catches currently. And if this was addressed or mentioned in the presentation or follow-up discussion and I miss it, my apologies. And I don't know who to direct the question to, maybe somebody with knowledge of some of these fisheries. I guess what I'm interested in is just knowing what the relative soak time is in the various fisheries, that bottom gillnet fisheries that might interact with sturgeon. It's not critical to have a tight timeline. It's just it's an interest because time matters. And if anybody has any info and can speak to that, I'd appreciate it. If not, we could follow up later. Thank you.
Spencer?
So I'll just note that as was said in the presentation, varies heavily based on the fishery that you're talking about. And so I'm going to guess that, fisheries that exist for spiny dogfish, bluefish, et cetera, off of the Chesapeake or off of Delmarva, maybe have a different set of practices than, for example, groundfish gillnet vessels. I do know that, we do have different categories of gillnet vessels for the groundfish fishery in particular. So we have day vessels that leave their gear in the water and go out every day and tend it. So it's either 24, 48 hour, 72 hour soaks. We also have trip gillnet vessels that actively tend the gear and I think assume have shorter soak times. And similar with some of the fisheries like spiny dogfish, where catch rates are very high, you typically tend to gear more frequently than, for example, than leaving it out overnight, because the catch rates are high enough that you have to take that gear up, or else your net's going to be full or ripped to shreds. So I don't have exact numbers for you, but I think the answer is that it heavily varies based on the fishery that you're talking about.
All set, Pete? Okay, very good. Mr. Pappalardo, then Mr. Bellavance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Spencer. A couple of quick questions. Most of what I wanted to say or ask has already occurred, but the areas of focus, those aren't exclusive, are they? I mean, I think what I understood your presentation to say is these are areas of note, but they're not that management measures, either through the council or through the service, wouldn't focus exclusively on these boxes.
Correct. These are not things that are necessarily, the boxes aren't necessarily like binding or anything. The council can choose to do, if the council takes it up or the agency takes it up, they're not bound by the action plan to, you know, implement measures only in these areas. So if there was an area that we identified later or as something that might need like a seasonal closure or a seasonal gear measure or something, nothing in this action plan prevents the councils or the agency from addressing that. And nothing says necessarily that all of the areas of focus here have to be addressed. So for the Gulf of Maine, for example, it's the, I think, the area here with the least amount of bycatch comparatively to the New Jersey and Long Island areas. You know, nothing in this action plan says that has to be addressed. I just will note that we need, that the biological opinion requires us to reduce bycatch by 2024. And so the way in which we do that is flexible.
Okay. In the presentation, you single out multi-species monkfish, and I think it's dogfish. Those are the areas of focus for the New England Council?
In terms of, so are you...
Let me ask you a different question. What about the skate fishery?
So the skate fishery, yeah. So when I went through the presentation, I neglected to mention the skate fishery. The skate fishery is something that, you know, they use gillnets and were included in the FMPs that we looked at. I'll note that the information that we used, I think it was 2017. See, the 2017 commission stock assessment or another report from them that identified, it's in the action plan itself, that identified those fisheries as being the ones that contribute the most to sturgeon bycatch, particularly for the gillnet fisheries. And so the recommendation, or the actionable conclusions that I listed out that highlighted the monkfish, spiny dogfish, and molts fisheries was derived from that piece of information. I will note that fisheries like the skate and the spiny dogfish and to some extent the bluefish fisheries, you know, those fisheries don't have their own, you know, don't necessarily have all of their own gear measures. And so, you know, things that we, that might be implemented through the monkfish or Northeast multi-species FMPs, you know, would apply to other fisheries that have measures based on those FMPs.
Right. Yeah, that's why I was, excuse me, that's why I was asking. So I guess it's safest for the New England Council to just basically think wherever we permit gillnet gear to fish, we should be focused on. And compare that with whatever information you all have produced through this report concerning sturgeon interaction. And those are the filters you all are gonna apply to this problem.
Spencer?
I think I'm not sure I necessarily got that. I think that makes sense, but maybe said a different way.
Let me restate it. Instead of thinking about things FMP by FMP, at the highest level, we should just say wherever sink gillnet gear is permitted, we need to think about potentially putting up sturgeon conservation measures against that gear. And then we can come down a level and think about how we would do that through which plan.
Thank you for rephrasing that, because that makes much more sense. And I think that that's certainly a valid approach for you to take, and I think it makes sense.
Okay. One last question. In your report, in your presentation, you made reference in a bullet that there was, I forget what the adjective was or the adverb was, but a lot of bycatch in the trawl fishery south of Long Island. Which fishery or fisheries were those, and should the trawl fisheries be thinking after gillnets are handled, trawls next? Kind of so, like the whale thing went after the lobster fishery first because it was the highest rate of interaction, and now it's dealing with other fixed gear. Is that the process?